It's upsetting too a little bit, because I remember being like a normal watch enthusiast kind of before I like dove headfirst into all this, and to have the kind of, I hate to call it naive expectation, that you can walk into a store and like buy one of these the day that you're ready, because I've been there. It sucks. It's a really unfortunate thing.
Yeah. Imagine going to the store to buy a G-Shock, right, and then the salesman going like, get out of town. We haven't had any of those for years. You got to be kidding me, kid.
You have to buy a ton of Timex, yeah, to have enough buying cred in here to buy this Casio.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week we've got a fun two-parter for you. First up, I've got Danny on the show to talk about his column Watching Movies, where he talks about watch spottings in movies and the story behind how those watches ended up on screen. We're going to talk about his five favorite columns, some big picture things he's learned about the movie industry, and how some new commercial dynamics may actually be transforming things for the better. After that, you're going to hear the results of the Hype Watch Fantasy Draft from a few weeks back. The results were a little bit lopsided, and I'm not going to tell you who won right now. You're going to have to listen through for that. But we'll also do a little recap of the draft, talk about some things we each think we maybe could have done to assemble an even better collection, and just a little bit about the nature of hype watches in general. Now, before we get into the show, I've got a little bit of bittersweet news to share. This is going to be my last time hosting Hodinkee Radio. I'm actually leaving Hodinkee to try some new challenges, and I'm excited, but also it's sad. It's the end of an era, and I just want to take a moment to thank all of you for making this show what it is. Without an audience, an engaged audience, it doesn't work. It doesn't exist. So to everyone who listens to the show, to everyone who's ever commented, to everyone who's ever voted in a fantasy draft, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. This started as an out of left field idea that Gray and I had one day, and it's grown into something I think we're both really, really proud of. So, I'm kind of at a loss for words, but thank you so much. I've met so many incredible people, both the guests on the show and listeners, and I hope we'll all see each other down the trail somewhere soon. The show is going to take a break for a little while. It'll be back soon enough, and I'm sure it's going to be exciting, so please watch this space. But for now, for one last time, let's do this. Hey, Danny, how's it going?
Hey, Steven, it's going well. How about you?
I'm doing good. It's a nice, sunny, beautiful day here in Santa Monica, California. Can't really complain.
It is. I'm actually in DC again for a little bit, and it is steamy and humid and gross, but I am jealous of
you. Come on out here, man. Go have lunch on the beach. I'm waiting for you.
I'd love to.
Anytime, my friend. Well, we're here to talk about your column. We're here to talk about watching movies, which has been something that you brought to the site, a couple months ago now, and has just been a runaway success. People seem to love it.
Yeah, it was something that I didn't actually think would do as well as it's doing, but I think I'm a known movie lover, I think, on the site at this point, and I'm learning that a lot of the readers are too.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what was the idea that kicked this column off? Like when did you say, like, okay, this isn't just like random watch spottings, but like we can go a step deeper here? How did that kind of come about?
You know, it actually came about in a different kind of way. I was working on a piece to sort of give people what to watch this weekend, and I was going to compile a list of a bunch of different movies that I liked that I thought had interesting watches in them. And I would point out what the watch was and where to look for it, et cetera, et cetera. And in talking to Nick Marino a bit, we thought, you know what, why waste all of these on a weekend when we can kind of fold this into the mix and kind of focus it on a movie every week. And it's tough to plan out a column, you know, to have something that's recurring, but there's really no shortage of movies out there. Plus, it gives me an excuse to watch movies.
Never, ever a bad thing.
Never a bad thing. And it gives me an excuse to rewatch movies that I love. But what I'm trying to do is on occasion, you know, try to find a timely hook for why to watch the movie this weekend, whether it's an event that's going on, something to do with the actor in the film, maybe they're appearing in a new movie that's out in theaters. But really just give like you know, as timely and interesting, and make sure that the movie's interesting and the watch is interesting. Sometimes those don't always, you know, come when I'm not talking like pure cinema every time. It might be a blockbuster, but, you know, give all different kinds of movies a chance.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. I really like that. And I love you said appearing in movies in theaters, which is
such a fun idea. I didn't even realize what I said.
I am yet to go back to a theater, but God, I can't wait. I love going to the movies.
That was like sensory memory. I was like, yeah, theaters. Yeah, sure.
I love it. Oh, God. Listening to the folks over, I mean, we talk all the time on this show. People know that you and I are huge fans of The Ringer, but hearing, you know, Fennessy and Chris Ryan talk about going to see stuff in theaters just has like my heart racing at this point.
The only movie I saw in the last, you know, in the pandemic years was with our own Cole Pennington. He and I went to see Tenet together in a completely empty theater. It was just the two of us. It was the most wild experience ever.
I really hope you guys did like a cute like rom-com thing where you sat like 20 seats apart from each other, or like in the center 100%. Row. You're like throwing 100%. Popcorn. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Good. I'm just going to keep that in my mind's eye every time now I think about that movie.
It was lovely.
You're a big movie guy, and you've said that, and it's known, you know, certainly your colleagues know it, but I think you're right. The listeners and readers know it too, but you know, diving into this, like what are some of the most interesting things you learned kind of big picture about movies or about watches in movies as you started doing these watching movie stories?
Well, you know, I, like many cinephiles or movie fans, had like a romantic connection to the making of movies.
Yeah.
I'm the kind of person that like back in when we used to buy, you know, DVDs would watch the special features first.
Danny director commentary over here.
Director commentary, making of featurettes, making of features, you know, the whole thing. Like I love how movies are made. It's my favorite part about them. There's just like a certain kind of magic to it that I really continue to appreciate no matter what happens. And that's watches are like one of the ultimate behind the scenes kind of things. You know, they're props obviously, but we write about watches on Hodinkee every day. There's stories behind every single watch. The sheer fact that a watch is in a movie is a story.
Yeah.
But oftentimes there's a story behind that story. And learning that those really do exist, obviously there's like certain situations where you get deflated when you find out, you know, oh, that, you know, there's either a replica watch or, you know, a certain, you know, member of the props team has no idea why they picked the watch. It was just there. Those kind of sure. things definitely, you know, I don't get too happy about when I find those things out, but for the most part, there's a lot of passionate people in the industry I've learned. And, you know, whether it's an indie movie or a Marvel television series, to find out that there are watch stories present in those things is really, really, really cool.
Yeah. I love that. Let's get into your top five here. You've written, you know, at this point when we're recording this, you've written, what, 15 of these?
That's right.
And so, you know, we're not calling from a huge, huge list here. We're not taking, you know, top five of 100, but I think it's worth recapping some of the best ones. But before we do that, I got one quick question for you.
Hit me.
What's your favorite DVD? If people are going out and buying a DVD with all those extras, what's your favorite DVD all time?
Oh, man, this is tough. My favorite DVD.
For the record, I did not prep you for this question
That's
at all.
That's fine. Okay, ready? I got it. My favorite DVD is There Will Be Blood.
Oh, great answer.
Because, and first of all, for the Ringer fans out there, I think there's a 2007 movie draft coming up on the Big Picture podcast, which is...
Oh, sick.
It's a killer movie year. So There Will Be Blood came out in 2007. There's some special features on there that give you this like really weird inside look, like an old black and white documentary at early Gilded Age America, oil baron America, that is not necessarily like your standard fare special feature, but it's almost like a thematic accompaniment to the movie. So you can like saturate yourself in the era before putting the film on. And it's like one of the weirdest special features I've ever seen, but it makes the viewing experience like that much better. Because that movie is probably a top five movie for me all time.
Yeah, and, I would agree.
It's just like one of those things where a DVD special feature heightens the viewing experience in a way that like you would never expect.
There Will Be Blood is a top five all-time movie for me. It's not even my favorite movie from 2007.
Right. I mean, am I gonna go ahead and guess that No Country for Old Men's your favorite movie from 2007?
No, actually. No Country is probably like a top 15 or top 20. Okay. Zodiac is my favorite movie from 2007.
Oh, yes. And interestingly enough, Zodiac, like the most underrated 2007 movie to come out that year. It was nominated for, like, I'm pretty sure, zero Oscars, which is criminal. Because it might even be David Fincher's best movie.
Personally, I think it is David Fincher's best movie. I also think it's Jake Gyllenhaal's best movie. I also think it's maybe the best watch movie of that decade. There's the scene where they're interviewing who they believe to be the killer, and he has a Zodiac watch on, and they take his watch off and look at it. And they have this like moment of recognition where they recognize that the symbol that the serial killer is putting on the letters is the same as the logo for the watch company. And they just can't get charges to stick to charge this guy with the murders. It's like an integral plot point in the movie. It's amazing. I love that movie. 2007, also super bad. 2007. It's a good movie year.
I love it.
Really, really good movie year.
Yes. It's a great movie.
Oh, Michael Clayton. I forgot about Michael Clayton.
Another good one. There's Wes Anderson put one out that year. No. Zodiac is, I think it's over 3 hours or just at 3 hours. And it's one of those movies where when it's done, I just put it back on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's honestly that good.
I watch that movie at least once a year. I absolutely love that movie.
It's interesting they brought that one up because it goes to your question. Like, that's the kind of movie where there's a watch in it, like a good watch with a good story behind it that connects to the title of the movie, the pseudonym of the serial killer. But the movie also touches on like classic Hollywood.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, one of the suspects was I think he was either a poster designer or worked in a movie theater. Yep. You know, the guy who had that creepy basement. So the movie touches on like hard journalism, good watches, classic Hollywood, and it's just like a great movie. So that's awesome.
It's kind of a perfect SJP movie too. It's like all my favorite things.
It's so good.
All right, before we make this just the 2007 draft pod, before we scoop Fennessy and Co. on this, let's do your top five watching movies column. So let's count them down, five to one. What is up at number five?
So number five was actually the first one that I did.
Okay.
It was, the film was 3 Days of the Condor, which is
awesome.
A Robert Redford movie from the mid-70s, and I learned through my time at Hodinkee in sort of interacting with watch enthusiasts on Instagram and talking to a lot of collectors that some of these movies that I thought were obvious that I'd watched a bunch of times, no one had ever seen. And 3 Days of the Condor was one of them. Mm. And it's a great movie, just period. It's one of an early Sidney Pollack directed film, and Redford wears like a massive bun strap. So it's like you can't miss like his wrist, and on it is a Doxa Shark Hunter.
Sick.
Which it's like, it's perfect because we're in the 70s, like the height of Doxa, and he's wearing it. Like oftentimes we like assume these watches were popular, but most of the time they were kind of esoteric and like we've made them popular now.
Yep.
But it's amazing to see like in the moment, you know, a big, thick, bulky dive watch.
Yeah,
just
agreed.
Like, and he works for the CIA. So, you know, it's one of these like I think his job in the film is they basically like they have to read their like a high amount of books and like documents in order to like find out if there are any like codes hidden inside of them. So he's like a back office guy wearing this like massive dive watch on a bun strap.
Incredible. Yeah, it's a fantastic movie. And the watch, like you said, is like maybe should have been nominated for like best supporting actor. It's a pretty killer prominent feature there.
For sure.
All right, what's up at number four?
So number four was the reason I put it on here. It's not a great movie. It's Lucy in the Sky. It's like a little known Natalie Portman movie from 2019. That's interesting for a couple of reasons. I think the director Noah Hawley is known for a lot of the FX shows that he's done. So like notably like Fargo and Legion, which are like big shows. I think there's like a huge, you know, fan base for the Fargo television series, the anthology series. But the movie has a 21% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which I love.
Oof.
I love that though, because I vehemently disagree with. I don't know exactly how the Rotten Tomatoes algorithm works, but it's broken for sure. So whenever I see these, I'm like, I'm gonna watch this. Full disclosure, movie wasn't great. It wasn't 21% bad, but it wasn't great. But the reason that I picked it is because Natalie Portman wears an Omega X33.
Okay.
She plays an astronaut in the film, but you very...
I was going to say, yeah. if you're wearing an X-33, you basically have to be an astronaut.
Exactly. And it was the classic X-33, and you very rarely like see, honestly, and this is like a Hollywood problem, women in films wearing like notable watches. Like, it's not like they're not wearing watches, but this is like a this is like a heavy hitter, and one that like we barely see in movies generally. And she's in the movie with John Hamm, who wears like a classic Speedy. So this one just felt like an obvious choice. And
nice.
The watch appears all over the movie. She literally never takes it off. So it's just cool. I love that in the movies when it feels like the watch is part of the character because they wear it like to sleep. It's super cool.
Agreed. Yeah. Also, like, Natalie Portman, John Hamm. Isn't Dan Stevens in that movie too?
He is. He plays her husband.
Yeah, like that's a good trio, you know. I'll buckle up and spend.
It's got a great cast. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I'll spend like 2 hours with that trio of people
for sure.
All right, what's at number three?
So number three, we've got, I think, a movie you like as well, Nightcrawler.
Yes,
this is a great movie.
God, I love this movie. I think I texted you over the winter. I rewatched this movie for the first time in a while. And I think I texted you at some obscene hour because I forgot that we are on a 3-hour time difference now.
Right.
And was like, holy shit, the watch at the beginning of Nightcrawler. And you were like, I'm sleeping. It's 2:30 in the morning. Stop texting me. But
thanks. Thanks so much. Bye. But it's true. I mean, like this, I remember when I saw the movie again, theater reference in theaters, like at the beginning of the movie, he like beats a security guard, I think to death, and steals his Breitling, like right off his wrist.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fit at all. It's like 8 links too big.
Yep.
And he just wears this watch dangling off his like malnourished wrist. Cause in this movie, Jake Gyllenhaal is extremely thin.
Yeah.
Like alarmingly thin, but he plays this like deranged cameraman. Like he's out there freelancing for local news stations, getting like the most gruesome footage possible. But he also takes things like way too far and starts dressing, you know, accident scenes and murder scenes to get a better shot, you know, for those videos. But the whole time he's got this Breitling on, and most of the time you see him with it, you can see the clasp on the top of his wrist because the watch fits so poorly. But it's a great movie, and you know, you don't see Breitlings that often, and this was just cool to see.
Yeah. This is in my top pantheon of Gyllenhaal movies. It's one of those movies that, like, if people are into, like, weird movies, this is one of the movies I always recommend people. I love this movie, and like I said, it had never struck me as a watch movie until the last time I saw it, and it jumped out at me immediately.
It's awesome. Highly recommended.
Perfect. All right, let's go number two. We're getting close to the top of the pyramid here. What is at number two for you?
So number two for me is another, what I consider to be another underrated Oscar snubbed kind of film. So it'd be First Man.
Oh,
so First Man was from 2018. Yeah, it's Damien Chazelle, who directed Whiplash and La La Land, which are both great movies as well.
Great movies.
This is one of those movies I think is going to age really well. I think movies like this tend to have like a longer tail.
Yeah.
It's shot in such an interesting manner. So depending on the scenarios, it'll be shot on 8mm film, 16mm film, 35mm film, and I think IMAX in some ways, but it's given that kind of grainy effect. So the whole movie is meant to make you feel like you're in the 1960s and what it would feel like to be in a rickety old rocket ship.
Yeah.
So like a lot of these movies make it seem like seamless and smooth, and Liftoff is like this like beautiful thing, but really inside, like, they don't make them like they used to for a reason.
Yeah.
And this movie like lets you know. So it's like a sensory overload. So, you know, make sure your speakers are properly tuned before putting it on. But it's also an Omega showcase. I mean, obviously. We're talking 1960s. This is when the Moonwatch came to prominence. But at the same time, you see Gosling, who plays Neil Armstrong, wearing an old, you know, 34mm Omega CK2605.
Yep.
Which many have mistaken for Seamaster, which it's not. But it's just like an old standard Omega wristwatch.
Yep.
It's about as standard as you get. And then you see all manner of Speedies. You have the Ed White. You have like the classic Moonwatch. And every person on screen is wearing one because they were issued.
Yeah.
And my understanding about this movie, and which is why I put it so high on the list, is that the production designer on the film worked with Omega, and this is a guy by the name of Nathan Crowley, who I spoke to back when I did an article on the movie Tenet, because he's also the production designer on that film. But they worked with Omega to make sure they had like the actual references and the extracts and the real, and so they put a lot of thought into making sure this was period correct. And I think that's, to me, that's important.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it shows. I mean, it's really, like you said, a showcase for period Omega watches. And I mean, to your point about speakers, real quick, this is definitely a see it in theaters kind of movie. But if you're going to watch this at home, the only time I've rewatched this, I did it with giant headphones on, like big cans, cranked a little bit too loud to where I was like slightly uncomfortable. I think that's the move. If you're going to watch this movie at home, I think this is a headphones movie.
Absolutely. Also, it has a really, really, really nice score. Like the musical score to this movie is
yeah, it does.
Quite beautiful.
Has a really good score. All right. What is at the top here? What is the number one, your personal favorite watching movies so far?
So my personal favorite for a few reasons is Uncut Gems.
Yes.
It's just
perfect.
It's just a cool, first of all, an unnervingly good movie. Like if you have any kind of anxiety, it's going to play on all the anxieties you have at once. And yet it's still a great example of how filmmaking in the conventional sense is still very much alive. It's an awesome Adam Sandler performance. But the reason I picked this is because I got a chance to speak to the prop master for the film, Catherine Miller. And the stories behind the watches are as cool as just seeing them in the film.
Yeah.
She went through such lengths to make sure that she was getting period correct watches that would fit the sort of Diamond District aesthetic in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So she was going down there in New York City to the Diamond District to find these kind of like iced out Rolexes. And Adam Sandler's character in the movie wears a few watches, but the most popular one he wears is this kind of smoke dial, red dial day date with diamonds everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, bracelet, bezel, numerals. It is like the pinnacle of like what you can do aftermarket to a Rolex.
Yeah.
And she had a few options. So if you go read that piece, you'll see these behind the scenes pictures that she gave us of like, maybe I want a black dial version. Maybe I want one with just diamonds on the bezel. Maybe I want just a standard day date. And in speaking to her, Sandler had a say in these things. So like the directors, herself and Adam Sandler were huddled around a table with watches on it. And he was giving his opinions on which ones he thought would fit the character best. And I just love that. I think that's the absolute coolest thing ever when everybody kind of has a say and the watches feel that much more personal. But the movie is great because there's basically a watch for every act of the film.
Yep.
And each time he has one, some form of a loan shark takes it away from him.
Yep.
Because he has not paid a debt. And I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I love that Rolex is pretty prominently featured in the movie poster too. It's like front and center. Like you can identify the watch just from the movie poster. You don't need to watch a second of the film.
Don't give away my secret, Steven.
it kind of tells you what the film is going to be though in a cool way. Like I to your point, like each act of this movie, the watch kind of fits what's going on and like is, again, it's like a character in the film, which I love.
That's right.
I mean, also to your point, like I don't think I've ever been so close to having a panic attack while also having fun as I was while I was watching this movie. Like
right.
At the end of it, right. I legitimately went for a walk around the block. Like I was still living in New York at the time. And like, I watched it at home with my wife. And like afterwards, it was like, you know, 11:30 at night. And I was like, I gotta go for a walk. I'll be back in 20 minutes. Like I was wound so tight.
Right.
It's
right.
Great. I love it. And would say like, you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the movie, all five of the films Danny's just mentioned are great. I've seen all five of them, except actually, I take that back. I've seen four out of the five of them. I have not seen Lucy in the Sky, but this is the one you gotta go check out immediately. All right. Well, those are your top five. Are there any films or any like watches in films that you love that as you've considered this column just like didn't fit, but you want to shout out here? Any just favorite like watch appearances that maybe aren't watching movies?
Well, not necessarily, but when I was thinking about this, I thought about another article that I wrote for the column, which was Kramer versus Kramer. And it put my watch spotting skills to the test because there was really no definitive answer on what the watch was. And if you know any movie from the 70s, you're not going to get high level imagery to be able to zoom in and try to find out.
Right.
And much to your comment about Uncut Gems, all of the promotional images for the film, like posters, promo shots, show Dustin Hoffman wearing his own personal Rolex GMT Master,
yeah,
Pepsi. I think it was a 1675. And that's not in the movie.
They did that just to mess with you, Danny. This was a long con.
Exactly. It goes to what you were saying. Like, if you were to look at those, you could go on some, you know, forum and be like, yeah, Dustin Hoffman wears a GMT Master. And then you would totally sell yourself out as never having seen the film. I mean, it's a great trick because what he does wear in the film is an absolutely totally obscure PVD coded chronograph on one of those old, they're rubber straps that look like links. So they're like bracelet-like. So even if like for half the time, I think it's a bracelet until like I see an underside of his wrist. And it turns out it's this old watch called a Le Jour chronograph. And it's this design style that actually was, you know, seen in a whole list of different kinds of watch brands. Heuer had one very similar. A brand called Wackman had one that was similar. There were a whole host of them. And so like, if you went online and tried to find it, most people would just say, oh, it's a Heuer. But it wasn't. And it took such a long time and so much effort to finally land on what it actually was. And
yeah,
it just goes to show you, like, I enjoy this column so much that I really want to try to offer some level of a definitive answer on stuff that's hard to find.
Yeah.
And just know, and my wife will tell you, I'm really doing this. I'm pausing movies and hitting the space bar on my computer so fast to get the perfect screen grab, you know, like frame by frame.
Yeah.
And it's tough. And it sounds stupid, but it's fun, honestly.
That's awesome. Well, the last thing I want to talk about is kind of a bigger picture thing. And what made me think of it is the Wolf of Wall Street column and the fact that, like, the very nature of watches and movies has changed, you know, like back in the 70s, like you could get Dustin Hoffman wearing his own watch on the movie poster and then a totally different, just like random, whatever thing that a prop master found in a film. Now, you know, depending on the actors, maybe someone's a brand ambassador, maybe somebody's, you know, contributing some production dollars to the film to have their watches featured, just like we see with all kinds of consumer products and brands. It's really kind of changed the game, right?
So for sure, like, you very rarely see actors wearing their own watches on screen. But interestingly enough, this very recent Watching Movies column I just did on Marriage Story with Adam Driver was one of the few that I ever come across. So he was wearing his own personal Rolex OP39, the blue dial with the green markers on it in the movie. I think part of that has to do with it being a somewhat of an independent type feature. But still, like, when you find that out, the watch takes on a different kind of character. But for the most part, you either have some kind of a brand partnership or a product placement that is involved in the on screen. And one of the places that really bore itself out most obviously was in The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
I think famously, a lot of people, going back to that Dustin Hoffman example, would look at that movie, see a gold watch on his wrist with a black bezel and a black dial and go, that's a Submariner. Period.
Yeah.
Like, I know what that is. I don't need to look any closer. What else would it be? We're in the late 80s, early 90s or whatever, you know, that's clearly what that watch is, but it's not. And when you look closer at it, you discover it's a Tag Heuer and it's not even actually gold. It's gold plated. And it raises a bunch of different questions. Like, why is that watch in that movie? And, you know, part of what I try to do in this column is get other voices mixed into the mix to try to get some background on it. And I spoke to the prop master of that movie, and the answer is, like, fairly obvious. Leo DiCaprio was a Tag Heuer ambassador, period. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. And on the first day of filming, he showed up and they were talking about, not the first day of filming, but the first day of probably pre-production, they were talking about the watches they would wear. And Leo was like, look, I have this partnership with Tag. I can easily have watches dropped off. It's really not a problem. I'll have them bring some watches over. I'll give them the era that we're working with and we can pick them from there. And that's why you see Tag Heuer so prominently featured in the movie. And, you know, I wrote in the story that it's fitting for somebody like Jordan Belfort to wear a gold-plated watch because he's pretty much a gold-plated person. You know, I thought that was, yeah, you know.
Exactly.
It fits for sure.
Yeah, that's super cool. And I'm kind of like hopeful that maybe we'll see more stuff like that and it'll get, you know, kind of like with First Man, right? Where like when you're working with a brand, you can get access to cool archival stuff. And you know, it can act, despite the fact that there's obviously a commercial angle to it, you can sometimes get better, cooler, more interesting watches. It doesn't have to be purely just like product placement.
I agree. I think that's how, and many people are quick to say, you know, about brands like Hamilton and things like that. It's like, there's a good amount of thought that goes into these, like you're saying, Stephen, just because you're working with a brand doesn't mean you're phoning it in. It doesn't mean there are conversations that take place where a brand can be way more helpful to you in terms of being period correct on a film than it would be to try to go and find something from a vintage shop somewhere.
Totally.
And you don't know what you're getting. And a lot of times with a brand, you know that it's coming from a museum or from their archives, and you know it's legit. And the actors, again, have input in this. I mean, Leo could have picked a brand new Tag and it could have been totally period incorrect because the brand wanted him to show off a certain model. But it's very clear that wasn't the case in this movie. And there are movies out there where there are serious goofs when it comes to watches being period incorrect. So I want to give credit to, you know, to that situation in this movie, because it could have gone completely different. And to that point, there's in that movie, Jonah Hill wears a Rolex Daytona and it's not real.
Right.
Which I want, you know, there's some conjecture in the movie industry right now about whether or not you're even allowed to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think there are rules being implemented where you cannot pass a watch off as something that it's not. Mm-hmm. And I think this came out before that was instituted. But again, these guys are like the worst of humankind. And the fact that they're simultaneously wearing a fake gold Daytona and a gold plated watch, it's awesome.
Yeah, I agree. Well, dude, thanks for doing this. This is awesome. I can't wait to see some of the movies coming next. I mean, you know, peek behind the curtain here. Like, I have no insight into what Danny's going to publish on this every week. So I wait for Friday like everybody else. And thanks for giving us the insight here, and look forward to future watching movies, Danny.
Appreciate it, Stephen. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Up next, we've got the results of the Hype Watch Fantasy Draft. Hey, good to see everybody. How are you guys doing?
Hey, Steven.
Good. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, Stevie.
Good to hear your voice, Steven.
Thanks, man. We got Gray on the mic today. That's big news.
Exciting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Pumped to be here.
Those dulcet tones, my friend.
Yes, indeed. Did all my vocal exercises. I'm ready to go.
Perfect. Total pro. Gray being here means we've got fantasy draft results, right?
Yes, indeed. The results have been tabulated, and I have a lovely spreadsheet and pie chart in front of me. I will say there's one color that is a dominant presence in this year pie chart.
Oh boy, that makes me nervous right off the bat. I don't like any of that.
Who is the Hype Watch King?
The hypest.
The beauty of radio is you can't see Gray with his eyes to the ceiling, shaking his head. That is not a good look for me. I am not feeling confident now. But so we got the results of the Hype Watch Fantasy Draft from a couple weeks back. I've got Cole, Danny, and James, and myself. We each put together a collection that included a Gerald Genta or Gerald Genta style watch, a waitlist Rolex, a big name collaboration, and some sort of high-end independent or exciting independent. And now we'll find out whose collection reigns supreme. Gray, you want to maybe count us down from 4-1 and let us know who won in this landslide?
4-1, that is the custom. We'll begin at the 4 spot, drum roll please. With 13.5% of the vote, we have Mr. Cole Pennington coming in.
Oh my God. 4. I won the last one though. So it's fine.
I won the last one, though.
So it's
okay.
Fine.
That's not how that works. Okay. That's not how that works.
Yeah. Okay.
What was the percentage?
Danny, the percentage was 13.5.
That's a lot left on the table. There's a lot of percentages left.
There sure are.
Yeah, that's okay. That's a lot of points left. Oh boy.
Well, that brings us to number three. So at number three, at a jump of 0.2 percentage point, we have at 13.7.
Oh, no.
Our host with the most, Mr. Stephen Pulverin.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
All right, guys. The draft is canceled. That's it. It's off. We're done. I'm calling it. We're done. It's been nice knowing you. I'm out.
Shut
this
thing down.
Well, Stephen, you shouldn't feel too bad, because then another 0.2 percentage points higher, sitting at second place, is Danny, meaning that with whopping 58.9% of the vote, the far away winner,
8.9%,
James Stacey, our champion, the most hype.
All right. Congrats,
all right,
man.
James.
Congrats.
Oh my God. The TGN army is real.
It's true. That must be it.
Your boy can pick a watch every now and then. I've done a few of these.
So let's real quick, I'm just going to recap your collection here, James. You got, for your Genta style watch, you've got the AP Royal Oak QP, the titanium one with the salmon dial that everybody somehow forgot about or didn't know about. You've got a yellow gold Daytona on Oyster Flex for your Rolex. You've got an RM Nadal for your collab, and you've got the Grubel Forzi signature one for your indie.
Yep. Stand by.
I got to say, looking at it now, this seems like an obvious win for you.
Yeah. I mean, the people have spoken. What can I say?
Math checks out. I'm no math expert.
The people have spoken. What can I say? Let's put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah, that rounds up to 100 if you really move the decimal points around.
It's really, really a three-way tie and then James. It's not even fourth through first. Yeah. It's a three-way tie and then James out there.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So I guess the real question is, Cole and Danny and myself, what
went wrong?
What the hell could, yeah, exactly. What the hell could we have done differently? We kind of blew it on this one.
Can I just say the guy in last place was trying to argue that it should be a three-way tie for second?
No, actually, I know I'm out of my zone with this one. And to answer Steven's question, I think what I could have done differently is play to common taste rather than my own taste. So I would have to, you know, adapt a little bit of a different strategy. These are actually watches, given the parameters, that I would like, not what the people would like, but the people have spoken. So there it is.
I like all four of mine.
Yeah. I like all four of mine. I think I might've overthought this. I think I might've like gotten too smart by half here. Like I tried to like make interesting picks and tried to like shake it up a little bit. I think like not taking the Nautilus when I had the chance, probably stupid. Not taking a Daytona when I had a chance, probably stupid. Like, do I want the Tiffany blue OP more than a steel Daytona? Sure. But like most people don't, you know, like that's a weird thing. So yeah, I think that I probably outsmarted myself here.
Just too smart for your own good.
Yeah. I think you could throw the Milgauss into the mix for that one too. 100% a similar situation.
I got to say that the Milgauss is a strange choice, because I don't think there is a lot of hype. That's a great watch and I like it. And I actually like it better than the Rolex I picked, but it doesn't feel like a hype watch to me. It there's a hype behind that watch, but it's just because of that watch, not because of Rolex, because of the whole steel watch thing. Like,
yeah,
it's been a thing since they put the green crystal on it.
Agreed. There was a rule Steven put in that was like, I might have misinterpreted it, but we could have engineered hype through the draft. Do we think it should be or whatever? And I think I may have gone that route a couple times on my choices to my detriment. You know, what watch do I think should be a hype watch as opposed to what watch is a hype watch? I think it's where I lost.
Interesting.
I mean, I think just looking at James's collection, right? Like we've got Royal Oak, Daytona, RM, Grubel Forzi. It's kind of hard.
I think I only missed one of the of what's up there, but it'll come up in the other questions.
Yeah.
There's another brand that's like real hype right now that we didn't hit.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I think like you're talking about, especially like maybe we set Grubel aside, but like AP, Rolex, and RM, like that's the trifecta. Like that's what everybody wants. That's what everybody can't buy. That's what is on, you know, all the famous wrists. That's what's getting watch spotted. Like those are the watches. And I think it's cool that I think, James, you put together a collection here that hit on all those things, but not necessarily in the most expected way. Like it's not a jumbo with a blue dial. It's not even the white gold jumbo with the salmon dial. It's the titanium QP with the salmon dial. It's not steel Daytona black dial or steel Daytona white dial or even Daytona meteorite dial. It's yellow gold Oyster Flex, which I think is cool. Like, I think you kind of like played the hits, but you played them your own way, which I both respect and enjoy.
Yeah, I think in my mind I wanted to pick four watches that were, well, three, I guess. Again, I don't know how hype the Grubo 4Z really is. I don't think there's actually much hype in that at all. It's just a good watch, and it kind of rounded out something where, like, if you didn't like the RM, you might have liked my Grubo 4Z, so I might have kept your vote on that play. The hype thing is cool, but if you're actually going to buy it, do you really want the like poster of the hype, or do you want like a slight tweak that makes it kind of more personal and maybe speaks to you, your level of taste or something like that? So again, yeah, I think a weird titanium QP versus a solid gold or a steel or something like that. And the same with the Rolex. It's not even my favorite of the Daytonas. I just think it's the most kind of, it's leaning in the hardest to the idea that this is a hype model.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree. So what was indulge us here? What was the brand that you think we missed that you would add that you think is missing from your collection and from the draft more generally?
So I think I could have maybe even squeaked out a few more percent from you guys by not going with RM and instead going with Jorn.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agreed.
I think RM is a very divisive thing, whereas Jorn, nobody's really out there. Like, I'm sure there's people out there that don't want it or don't get it or don't care. And all of those are three fine ideas. But like the market is really speaking to the fact that Jorn's time has come.
Yeah.
And there's so much heat behind, you know, that the subscription one, which will go up this fall, you know, with all five. And there's just a lot of like attention behind them. And they still, you know, you could say the same sort of thing about Cartier, but of course Cartier is not even close to an indie. They're almost the opposite. They are the cathedral in the middle of watchmaking in some ways. Or you know, the old building that no one's ever going to tear down and likes to visit and take pictures of. But yeah, I think it'd be probably Jorn versus RM. And that was the struggle for me, is like, do you drop the GF and get an get a Jorn, or, you know, instead of going with the RM, go with something else?
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit that for my indie category, I had a list of like five different Jorns and like maybe one or two other things as like out of left field backups. But like, I was pretty set before the draft even started that I was taking some kind of Jorn in my indie category. I mean, a lot of good it did me, but I stand by that pick. You know, I think you're totally right. I think if we're talking about rising stars of hype right now, I think like Jorn is on a pretty steep upward trajectory, and I can't see the plateau yet. Like, I can't see over the top of the hill yet.
I think the reason we can't, like, it's hard to predict where they're going with Jorn or how hot it could get is because I don't know that it is that much hype. I think it's just a brand that's now starting to get its recognition outside of this small kind of Central European based set of collectors that were helping keep that brand alive and moving them into the next generation. And now there's a momentum. They have pieces. There's enough in the market that it's starting to trade hands with people that aren't part of these kind of closed mm-hmm. circles. So you're starting to see them more often. They speak to a wider range of prices now, you know, from the Chronometer Blue all the way up.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree with you that the like definition of hype maybe does Jorn a disservice here. I wonder how much we think the current prices are sustainable or going to continue to go up. Like, do we think that Chronometer Blues are six-figure watches in reality? Do we think that Jorn Tourbillons are $500,000 and up? Or do we think that's kind of like a blip on the way to somewhere between what they were selling for and what they're selling for now?
Blip.
I think it's pandemic pricing. So we're you know, yep. I think people mm-hmm. right now, what they want to do is, if you own one of these watches or if you own a certain set of car or something like that, you want to assume that the last, you know, year to 2 years is good case study for a new law that a GTR is worth $350,000.
Get out of here.
or that a Nautilus is worth $400,000, or that a Jorn is worth, you know, five, six, seven times what it might have sold for just a few years ago when it was made. And I think that will take some time to correct. There is an inherent value in what Jorn is creating.
Mm-hmm.
in that it's still actively being made. He's still alive. He's still working. He's still making things that people really like. And that means you're buying into the middle of a legacy rather than the end or something that like that's happened before.
Yeah.
It's the difference between, you know, if you were, imagine if you could trade stocks on film directors, you know, you'd probably pay less for a Denis Villeneuve than you would a Spielberg and even less there than you might for a Scorsese. But at, over time, there's going to be this balancing act between the three as their careers are at different positions.
That's just like the normal stock market in companies.
Hype. Yes, hype.
Yeah. If you guys had to add one category, like if we were to make this a five watch collection instead of a four watch collection, I'm curious what each of you would add had you been given the option. Maybe Danny, you want to kick us off here?
I would have done budget hype, like something like budget friendly hype watch. And what comes to mind is like the Casio, like something that like. It's obvious why the hype exists. The price is not like they're totally, you know, affordable in every metric of watch buying, but they're really hard to get. And there is a secondary market that's been created for those watches. That is the kind of thing that I'm not really into. You know, I'm not going to spend $600 to buy a watch that costs way less than half that. So it would have been interesting to see how many of those we could have come up with on a budget level.
Yeah,
I think I would have added hype watches of the past, kind of like how the early 2000s was filled with the big ass Panerais, and or even going before that, the Hublot Fusion watches that were hyped up and huge, like the things growing up, like and even in the micro, like Danny's talking about budget, like the Dreadnought. James will know about this. You know, the Dreadnought was a hype micro back in the day, and now it's like forgotten. So I would look at hype watches of the past that are just totally forgotten about now.
That's a great category. I would never have thought of that. That is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I agree. And I would agree with Cole and with Danny. Like, I think what might have been neat is to try and find the corner of this where the same thing is happening, but at a more accessible price point, where you still get this ridiculous amount of interest over a relatively limited supply of something, but it doesn't have to cost $100,000 or $500,000 or whatever. And you know, for me, I think the Casio's a great example. But before that, and pretty much anything from Halios, there's four or five brands now that the minute they even start taking the pre-order, it sells out. And part of that is because there's demand, but also there could be 1,000 or 2,000 people of the similar mindset that will buy these things because they've owned two or three of the previous ones, and they don't even need to see the new one. And because it's a small company, and when I mean a small company, I don't mean like, I mean, it's literally one person ordering stuff online and having it assembled and then doing QC, you know, out of an office somewhere. And because it's a small business, like a traditional small business, there's no scaling. If they decided they had the cash run for 200 units, that's how many there's going to be until they have more cash. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but we have a pandemic thing where stock is very difficult to get. So if you originally wanted to do 1,000 of your watch, maybe that's now 500 and it takes 8 months longer than expected.
Yeah.
So it is kind of a time where we're seeing compressed availability for many different reasons. And I think it would have been cool to attempt to highlight some of that in a sort of accessible price point element of the draft.
Yeah. I mean, budget is immediately where my brain went. And to be honest, when we, you know, Gray and I put these categories together, we thought about it and decided to kind of hold it to four categories. And I think it's telling that we've all kind of touched on that in some way. I think it's interesting that whether you're buying at the Jean Tourbillon RM level or whether you're buying like Timex Qs and Casio's and micro brands and whatever, like you can be spending $200 or $200,000 and actually run into like the same problem or the same challenges in trying to acquire the watch you want. And I think that's fascinating and kind of telling about where watch collecting is at, that the taste is so kind of like hyper focused no matter what part of the industry you're looking at.
It's upsetting too a little bit, because I remember being like a normal watch enthusiast kind of before I like dove headfirst into all this, and to have the kind of, I hate to call it naive expectation, that you can walk into a store and like buy one of these the day that you're ready, because I've been there, and to sort of be looked in the face, whether it's a Casio or a Rolex or whatever, to be like, I mean, I don't know what you're asking me.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of look that you're getting, it sucks. It's a really unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
Imagine going to the store to buy a G-Shock, right. And then the salesman going like, "Get out of town! We haven't had any of those for years. You got to be kidding me, kid!
You have to buy a ton of Timex to have enough buying cred in here to buy this Casio."
Brutal.
I will say, in the days when we could travel together pre-pandemic, it had become kind of like a running joke amongst the members of our team. You know, there's a peek behind the curtain for the listeners. To like when we would travel somewhere, whether it's Tokyo or Geneva or London or, you know, LA or wherever, to like if we walked by a Rolex or an AP boutique, to like go in and just like ask for a Daytona or a Jumbo and just see what the response is. And like often most folks in boutiques wouldn't know like that we work in the industry or that we're like a part of this at all. And watching like, you know, goading Ben or Enery or Will or one of you guys into like going into a Rolex boutique and being like, "Hi, I'd love a black dial Daytona, please. Here's my credit card," and having them just like not know how to handle it, you know, like, "Oh, sir, I don't know." It's so fun. Like, honestly, it's absolutely hilarious. And like, I'm sorry to the salespeople, but like, this is it. It's absurd that is what the watch buying experience is like nowadays. And I can't imagine if I like didn't work in this industry, how insane it would seem. I mean, I don't know about you guys. It's a question I get asked all the time, is people are just like, "Is this real? Like, is this like a fake thing? Are people messing with me? Like, is like, are any of these watchmaking companies like, is this a joke? Are they like purposefully, what's going on here?" Like, people just don't get it.
I don't see how it's sustainable, which is where my questions really lie.
Yeah, I mean, fair.
I don't get it.
It'll go on as long as it can, but I just don't think it can go on forever.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, we've had versions of this conversation before, all of us, sometimes maybe even on this show. But like, the concern for me is that if you're like a young person, if you're like a 20, early 20 something, mid 20 something, late 20 something person, you start making a little bit of money, you walk into a watch boutique and you're like, "I'm going to buy my first watch," or even if it's later, 30s, 40s, and you go in, you're like, "I'm going to buy a nice watch," and you go into the boutique and you ask for one and they're like, "Are you kidding me? Like, you can't get watches here. It's going to be a years long wait list." Or like you walk into a boutique and you're like, "I would like an $8,000 steel sport watch." And they're like, "Cool, you can have it if you buy a $40,000 gold dress watch also." Those people then just never buy watches. Like, those people don't go buy a different watch. They go buy a car, or they go on a vacation, or they buy a piece of art, or they invest in furniture. And then you've taken like a young, affluent person who could be a lifelong watch lover, and you've like turned the tap off at the beginning.
I think some of them do buy watches, and I think they all buy Speedmasters. and like I'm not laughing. Like, Speedmaster is not an incredible watch, because that's exactly what it is. They are great watches. That's a great way to spend your money if that's like, it suits your wrists and everything. But like, I genuinely believe that's what's happening. I've talked to people who are like, "Oh, well, yeah, I started out thinking I was getting a Sub or a Explore 2 or something like that. And then finally got so tired of the runaround, I just walked into an Omega boutique and they're like, "Yeah, we'll have one in like 4 or 5 days. Probably we'll just give you a phone call." And like, they had a lovely experience. Maybe it wasn't immediate. Maybe they waited a little while, but like a reasonable amount to wait for retail, for a kind of fastidiously made product. Yeah. I think that, I hope brands like Omega are seeing an option here where they can just clean up.
Yeah. Same.
The way I have always thought about this is like, what if Shell or Marathon Oil or something stopped giving gas to gas stations? What would the stock price of Marathon be? Or, you know, what if Wonder Bread stopped delivering bread to your local supermarket, and all of a sudden, like, what do you think about Wonder Bread now? So this is just an interesting exercise. What happens when you do not deliver the product that you are known to deliver?
It's the toilet paper dilemma, the pandemic toilet paper dilemma. You know?
But is it the brands or the consumers? Are we all buying the watches, or are they just not delivering the toilet paper to the stores? The toilet paper is in the stores. It's customers who are causing the problem there. You know?
I mean, the only thing I would raise, and this is a topic for a different discussion that would take longer, is you can't compare toilet paper and gas to a Veblen good.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah, sure. Yeah. Of course.
The market is artificial to a certain extent, and whereas it isn't for gas.
Right, but the young watch buyer that we're talking about wouldn't, it would take them a little while to arrive to that conclusion.
Sure.
Yeah, no, fair point. Yeah, for sure.
I guess to finish things off, I want to know, I'm going to ask each of you to give me two watches here to finish things off. the hype watch that you are most bought in on, where you think the hype is fully justified, and the hype watch that you just don't get. And it's not that you dislike the watch, but where you're just like, all right, not for me. Like, not, I'm cool. I'm going to sit this one out. So maybe let's start with the watch you'll sit out on, and then we'll go around again and do the watch we like most to wrap up. Danny, you want to kick us off here?
So I picked this watch. If you listen to the original recording, I didn't want to pick the watch, and it's the Nautilus. I don't dislike the watch at all. I just don't buy into the level of hype that surrounds the watch. So by definition of the question, this is that watch for me. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But when it comes to the market around the stainless steel sport watch, integrated bracelet watches in general, but specifically where the Nautilus has gone in terms of pricing, availability, what the secondary market looks like, et cetera, that auction price that we saw, I just can't wrap my head around that.
Nice. Cole, how about you?
Sure, I would say the Nautilus too, but I won't double up on that. I'll actually say the Royal Oak, because I think they're kind of the same buyer, the same watch. The reason I don't get it, or for me personally, is if I want a sports watch, I want to do sporting things, and I'm not going to buy, like, to me, high horology is best represented in a dress watch. Not, why take a brand that is so, has such prowess in the realm of high horology, and then make a sports watch when you can't really do sporting things with it, you know? So I just don't get that part of it. And it turns it into a fashion watch, which is like incongruent. What is it? Is it a fashion? Not fashion, like a fashion watch, like we use the term, but I mean, a watch that looks quote unquote dope, you know? That's why.
Okay. Fair.
Yeah. I mean, mine's the Nautilus. I will double up, because I think it's like, I think that watch is great for its price point. I understand why people enjoy it. For me, it is both historically and in my mind a second step from the Royal Oak. Mm. I think the Royal Oak, you know, being that first play from Genta. And then the other thing that gets me the Nautilus is like, I like the Aquanaut better.
Fair.
and it could just be that I'm gonna put this out there. It's getting less true by the day, but just like a younger man, or I was maybe when I first fell in love with the Aquanaut, right? Yeah. It's not as true as it once was, but 10 years ago, I would have been considered kind of, and I think that's what they made the Aquanaut for, was kind of a more sporty, something more like Cole said. I'm kind of agreeing with both these guys now, but with Cole, like, I like that there's something about the Aquanaut that is actually kind of sporty, and I like that obviously that the travel time is a dream watch.
Yeah. So
that one, I was seeing the $400,000 or whatever for a Nautilus, and I think like, oh, you could buy like a good down payment on a house in a good city plus an Aquanaut and a car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. You can get a whole lot for that. Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, I'm gonna go Daytona. Daytona's a great watch. I get it. It's a classic. It's awesome.
It's a good pick, yeah.
I don't understand why it's like still how many years after it came out, the current steel Daytona is still like one of the hardest watches to get on the planet. I just don't get it. And like to James's earlier point about the Speedmaster, like I might like the Speedmaster better. It's at least close, you know? I think those two watches are neck and neck. And the fact that you can walk in, get a Speedy at retail with little fanfare, and a Daytona gets you laughed out of a store, to me is just like, I just don't get it. I think it's kind of a mess.
Speedy's also a lot easier to read on wrist. Just saying.
True story.
Oh, and it also went to space.
Yeah, it also, what? Little thing, Cole, it did in fact go to space.
No way.
Actually, no.
Which space, though?
It went to the moon. Not even into space. It went to the moon. So don't forget that.
All right, I'm going to do the watch that I'm excited about, and then we'll go back around and wrap things up here. The hype watch that I'm most bought in on, it was a close race for me. I'm ultimately going to go Royal Oak Perpetual Calendars. Thought about going Jorn. I really believe in Jorn, but I'm going to go Royal Oak QPs. I think the Royal Oak is such an icon. It's such like a hot thing right now, but also you get the like real serious complicated watchmaking from AP, which I think is core to what they do and sometimes gets forgotten or lost in the mix. And to me, this is the best combo. You get Genta's iconic design and you get AP's like totally unassailable top tier watchmaking in one package. I prefer the old 39 millimeter ones in the jumbo case to the current 41s, but like whatever. Royal Oak QP. I think the hype is real there, and I'm bought in.
Which one though?
I mean, honestly, now probably the titanium and salmon one that James picked.
It's got to be that or the BA.
Maybe black ceramic.
Ooh,
is close, but yeah, that would be my pick.
Agreed.
James, you want to take it? Let's go, James, Cole, Danny.
Sure. Yeah, mine is one that we actually didn't chat that much about on the actual draft. But if we're talking about something that I get and it speaks to me, it's this progressive, you know, last 2-3 year like meteoric rise of Cartier interest. The hype is legit there, like it, and I'm sure that it'll be something of a bubble or a peak that comes back down. But I think that this is a brand that's been, you know, wasn't well equipped to do battle in the steel obsessed sport watch focus of the last decade. But now, as like a respite or a dessert or whatever you'd like to use, I think that it speaks to all the things that we like about a vintage Submariner, but doesn't do the steel dive watch stuff as well. So it's this entirely different wrist presence that doesn't lack in any way for charm or traditional value or watchmaking acumen or brand name, or even just that ability to see a tank from 30 feet away and go like, hey, it's a tank.
Nice. Good pick. Really good pick.
For me, I'm going to say the watch that there's a ton of hype over that I totally get and don't get at the same time, but we'll get into that, is the GMT Master 2. It is.
It's a great watch.
I've had one for a year now and I love it every day. And I actually could get, I won't for sentimental reasons, but I could get rid of everything else and just wear this watch for the rest of my life. No problem. I think it's gone horribly soft. And unfortunately, the people who want them now, which are causing the hype, are not the same people who would have worn them back when the watch was not popular in the 60s, 70s, so forth.
Yeah.
But I'm still sticking to it. I think having personal experience, totally get the hype, would buy one again, wouldn't buy a Batman, would only buy a Pepsi, but would buy one again. I see Danny shaking his head there, but so that's it.
Nice call.
Whatever, man. Whatever.
All right, Danny, take us home, my friend.
I'm gonna disagree with you.
Wow,
SJP.
Okay.
I'm gonna go Daytona is the one that I do get.
Oh, okay.
But
okay,
I'm gonna go black dial instead of white dial, even though they're both like equally hard to get. I just connect with that one a lot more for whatever reason. Completely agree with James' point about legibility. It's a tough one to read. Like, mm-hmm. Period.
It's not a glanceable sport watch. It's fine. You can look. You just have to take a split second longer. But if you're used to a Speedy, it's different, for example.
There's a lot going on the dial, yeah, too. I mean, just like, period. It's not the most elegant version of that watch historically, but something about the black dial with the ceramic back black bezel does it for me. Even the older ones with the steel bezel, I'm into. But in terms of hype, if I could ever get my hands on one of those, I'd probably go for it.
Nice. Well, I'd say to everyone listening, hit the site and let us know which watches you're in on and out on. Let us know in the comments on the post. I'm super curious what kind of answers we're going to get from people, because I think this is a pretty divisive topic, as you can tell based on the fact that, you know, we had two instances of disagreement here in this last little bit. But yeah, I'm really curious what the listeners and readers think. So hit us up in the comments, hit us up on social, and let us know. But thanks for doing this draft, guys. This was a super fun one. Really appreciate it. And more drafts, just more drafts all the time.
And congrats to James.
And to the 60% of voters,
yeah, you're
who voted
up
with their heart.
I love that you're rounding up there, much. James. You're rubbing it in our faces even more. All right. Okay.
That officially makes it a three-way tie at the bottom at that point.
Yeah, come on now. Come on.
A light rounding.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you, James.
I'll take that.
Thank you.
Got to win one every now and then.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.